He got out and checked the car. The driver's door was a little dented, right in the center. The bagman's face. No blood. He got back in and buckled up. 10 minutes later, he was in the Chateau Marmont's lobby, sitting in a faded velvet armchair, waiting for the others. 1,200 miles northeast of the Chateau Marmont, the dark-haired 40-year-old calling himself Alan Mason was riding the underground train from his arrival gate to the Denver airport's main terminal. He was alone in the car, sitting down, tired, but smiling all the same at the crazy bursts of jug band music that preceded the station announcements. He figured they had been specified by a psychologist to reduce travel stress. In which case, they were working. He felt fine. A lot more relaxed than he had any right to be. Chapter 28. Dinner cost Reacher way less than $900. Either out of taste, or preference, or respect for the context, or deference to his economic predicament, the others opted for a noisy hamburger barn on Sunset, just east of the Mondrian Hotel. There was no Norwegian water on offer, just tap and domestic beer, and thick, juicy patties and pickles, and loud vintage rhythm and blues. Reacher looked right at home, in a 50s kind of a way. The others looked a little out of place. They were at a round table set for four. Conversation stopped and started as the pleasure of being among old friends was overtaken by memories of the others who were missing. Reacher mostly listened. The dynamic of the round table meant that no one person was dominant. The center of attention bounced back and forth randomly. After 30 minutes of reminiscence and catch-up, the talk turned back to Franz. O'Donnell said,
"Start at the very beginning. If we believe his wife, he quit everything except routine database mining more than 4 years ago. So why would he suddenly launch into something this serious?"
Dixon said,
"Because someone asked him to."
"Exactly," O'Donnell said. "This thing starts with his client. So, who was it?"
"Could have been anybody."
"No," O'Donnell said. "It was someone special. He went the extra mile here. He broke a 4-year habit for this guy. Kind of broke faith with his wife and son, too."
Nagley said,
"It could have been a big payer." "Or someone he was obligated to somehow,"
Dixon said.
Nagley said, "Or it might have looked routine at the get-go. Maybe he had no idea where it was leading. Maybe the client didn't either."
Reacher listened. It had to be someone special. Someone he was obligated to somehow.
He watched as O'Donnell took the floor, then Dixon, then Nagley. The vector bounced around between them and traced a heavy triangle in the air. Something stirred in the back of his mind. Something Dixon had said hours ago in the car leaving LAX. He closed his eyes, but he couldn't get it. He spoke up, and the triangle changed to a square to include him.
"We should ask Angela," he said. "If he had some kind of a long-standing, big-deal client, he might have mentioned him at home."
"I'd like to meet Charlie," O'Donnell said.
"We'll go tomorrow, unless the deputies come for me, in which case you can go on ahead without me."
"Look on the bright side," Dixon said. "Maybe you gave the guy a concussion. Maybe he doesn't remember who he is, let alone who you are."
They walked back to the hotel and split up in the lobby. No appetite for a nightcap. Just an unspoken agreement to get some sleep and start work again, bright and early. Reacher and O'Donnell headed up together. Didn't talk much. Reacher was asleep 5 seconds after his head hit the pillow. He woke up again at 7 o'clock in the morning. Early sun was coming in the window. David O'Donnell was coming in the door, in a hurry, fully dressed a newspaper under his arm, cardboard cups of coffee in both hands.
I went for a walk, he said.
And?
You are in trouble, I think.
Who?
That deputy? He's parked 100 yards from here.
The same guy?
The same guy and the same car. He's got a metal splint on his face and a garbage bag taped across his window.
Did he see you?
Nope.
What's he doing?
Just sitting there, like he's waiting.
Chapter 29. They ordered breakfast in Dixon's room. First rule, learned a long time ago, eat when you can, because you never know when the next chance will come, especially when you're about to disappear into the system. Reacher shoveled eggs and bacon and toast down his throat and followed it with plenty of coffee. He was calm, but frustrated.
I should have stayed in Portland, he said. I might as well have.
How did they find us so fast?
Dixon asked.
Computers, Nagley said. Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. They can search hotel registers anytime they want now. This is a police state. We are the police, O'Donnell said. We used to be. I wish we still were. You'd hardly have to break a sweat anymore.
You guys get going, Reacher said. I don't want you to get snarled up in this. We can't spare the time. So don't let the deputy see you leave. Go visit with Angela Franz. Chase the client. I'll get back to you when I can. He drained the last of his coffee and headed back to his room, put his folding toothbrush in his pocket, and hid his passport and his ATM card and 700 of his remaining $800 in O'Donnell's suit carrier, because certain things can go missing after an arrest. Then he took the elevator down to the lobby, just sat in an armchair, and waited. No need to turn the whole thing into a big drama, running up and down hotel corridors, because second rule, learned from a lifetime of bad luck and trouble, maintain a little dignity. He waited. 30 minutes. 60. The lobby had 3 morning papers, and he read them all. Every word. Sports, features, editorials, national, international, and business. There was a story about Homeland Security's financial impact on the private sector. It quoted the same $7 billion figure that Nagley had mentioned. A lot of money. Surpassed only, the article said, by the bonanza for the defense contractors. The Pentagon still had more cash than anyone else, and it was still spreading it around like crazy. 90 minutes. Nothing happened. At the 2-hour point, Reacher got up and put the papers back on the rack, stepped to the door and looked outside. Bright sun, blue sky, not much smog, a light wind tossing exotic trees, waxed cars rolling past, slow and glittering. A fine day. The 24th day Calvin Franz hadn't been around to see. Nearly 4 whole weeks. Same for Tony Swan and Jorge Sanchez and Manuel Orozco, presumably. There are dead men walking, as of right now. You don't throw my friends out of helicopters and live to tell the tale. Reacher stepped outside, stood for a second, exposed, like he was expecting sniper fire. Certainly there had been time to get whole SWAT teams into position. But the sidewalk was quiet. No parked vehicles. No innocuous florist's trucks. No bogus telephone linemen. No surveillance. He turned left on Sunset. Left again on Laurel Canyon Boulevard. Walked slow and kept close to hedges and plantings. Turned left again on the winding canyon road that ran behind the hotel. The tan-crowned Vic was dead ahead. It was parked at the far curb. Alone, isolated, 100 yards away, still, inert, engine off. Like O'Donnell had said,
Its broken front passenger window was taped over with a black garbage bag, pulled taut. The driver was in the seat, just sitting there, not moving, except for regular turns of his head. Rearview mirror, straight ahead, door mirror. The guy had a real rhythm going, hypnotic. Rearview mirror, straight ahead, door mirror. Reacher caught a flash of an aluminum splint fixed across his nose. The car looked low and cold, like it hadn't been run for many hours. The guy was on his own, just watching and waiting. But for what? Reacher turned around and backtracked the way he had come, made it back to the lobby and back to his chair, sat down again with the seed of a germ of a new theory in his mind. His wife called me, Negley had said. What did she want you to do? Nothing, Negley had said. She was just telling me. Just telling me. And then, Charlie, swinging on the door handle. Reacher had asked, is it okay to be opening the door all by yourself? And the little boy had said, yes, it's okay. And then, Charlie, you should go out and play. And then, I think there's something you're not telling us. The cost of doing business. Reacher sat in the Chateau Marmont's velvet lobby armchair, thinking, waiting to be proved right or wrong by whoever came through the street door first. His old unit, or a bunch of fired-up L.A. County deputies. Chapter 30. His old unit came through the door first. What was left of it, anyway? The remnant. O'Donnell and Negley and Dixon. All of them fast and anxious. They stopped dead in surprise when they saw him, and he raised a hand in greeting. You're still here, O'Donnell said. No, I'm an optical illusion. Outstanding. What did Angela say?
Nothing. She doesn't know anything about his clients.
How was she?
Like a woman whose husband just died.
What did you think of Charlie?
Nice kid. Like his dad.
Franz lives on, in a way.
Dixon said, why are you still here?
That's a very good question, Reacher said.
What's the answer?
Is the deputy still out there? Dixon nodded.
We saw him from the end of the street.
Let's go upstairs. They used the room that Reacher and O'Donnell were in. It was a little bigger than Dixon's because it was a double. The first thing Reacher did was retrieve his money and his passport and his ATM card from O'Donnell's bag. O'Donnell said,
Oh, looks like you think you're sticking around.
I think I am.
Why?
Because Charlie opened the door all by himself.
Which means...
Seems to me that Angela is a pretty good mom. Normal, at worst. Charlie was clean, well-fed, well-dressed, well-balanced, well-cared for, well-looked after. So we can conclude that Angela is doing a conscientious job with the parenting thing. Yet, she let the kid open the door to a couple of complete strangers.
Dixon said, Her husband was just killed. Maybe she was distracted.
More likely the opposite. Her husband was killed more than 3 weeks ago. My guess is she's over whatever initial reaction she had. Now she's clinging to Charlie more than ever because he's all she's got left.
Yet she let the kid get the door.
Then she told him to go out to play. She didn't say to go play in his room. She said go out. In Santa Monica? In a yard, on a busy street full of passers-by, why would she do that?
I don't know.
Because she knew it was safe.
How?
Because she knew that deputy was watching the house.
You think?
Why did she wait 14 days before calling Negley?
She was distracted,
Dixon said again. Possibly, Reacher said. But maybe there's another reason. Maybe she wasn't going to call us at all. We were ancient history.
She liked Franz's current life better.
Naturally,
because she was Franz's current life. We represented the bad old days. Rough, dangerous, uncouth. I think she was disapproving. Or if not, then a little jealous.